So I have this slide up here to give credit to the people that did the work that I'm going to present. And like in the previous talks, please interrupt any time and ask questions. The work I'm going to present, actually a lot of it was done by Andrea, and she just reminded me that there's much better pictures of her out there. So she's.
That's a beautiful picture. What just, you this was.
Andrea and Bilal were the main players in the work I'm going to present. That's actually a picture of one of my former postdocs at after his wedding. I was the best man in his wedding in France, and he was jumping off this thing here into the lake at sunset and just happened to take that picture. Pretty cool. So we're interested in the cortex, and we're interested in whatever we can find out about how it works on a very basic level from what we can do, which is mostly intracellular recordings or patch clamp recordings or something like that, and you'll see in a minute what I mean exactly. So we're working at this level here in a single neuron, but we're really interested, at least I'm very interested in how the cortex works. Is there something we can talk about how it works as a network? And I'm hoping to convince you that there are things you can study at the single cell level that tell you something about how it works as a network. All right? And the reason that's true is because the cortex has massive synaptic connectivity. It has massive convergence and divergence on and from single neurons that allow it to do what it does, which in my opinion is it's a connection machine. It's a connection machine that is context dependent, meaning, you know, present goals, present environment, and past experience. So if you look at the cortex as a connection machine, and physically how it might do that is it's a sheet that if you unfolded it as was done for this macaque brain here, if you just cut it open and unfold it, it's approximately 2 millimeters thick. And for a macaque brain, it was equivalent on one side of about 7 inches in diameter. And for a human brain, it's about 16 inches in diameter, which if you look up on pizza.com, that's the official size of a large pizza in the United States. So it's about, you got two large pizzas, one for each side, about the thickness of the cardboard underneath the pizza, or about the thickness of the crust in New Haven. And and it's massively interconnected. You have...
Good thing you don't work in Chicago.
That's right. We have huge heads. And you all know that there are identified areas in this sheet that do unique tasks for different sensory motor modalities and processes you need to do. And these areas are all highly highly interconnected in this complex fashion. You know, like most of the cortex is the white matter, all the connections that need to be made to allow it to perform, to do this functional connectivity. All right. So I made some very basic statements here. This is all leading towards what we study. You'll see in a minute why. Cortical networks are widely interconnected and complex. This highly interconnected nature is designed to allow flexible behavior. All right. There's very little argument about that. Flexible behavior is possible because functional connections are highly dynamic on a rapid time scale. So this is something I want to address with our work. And this flexible behavior of the cortex allows activity to flow according to context and behavioral demands. This is a hypothesis, all right? And it's going to remain a hypothesis because we don't really study that, but we study something related to it, I think. All right, so the idea is that the cortex has this very complex anatomical connectivity that's, you know, on a time scale that I'm interested in, which means like right now, what I'm doing, moving my eyes around, move my hands around, move my body around, and still be able to interact in the world, hopefully, and give a presentation. So to do that, I have to be able to coordinate activity on the fly, you know, meaning time scale of tens of hundreds of milliseconds, connectivity has to be modulated, all right? So you have to put it as simply, you need to be able to have networks talk to each other that are appropriate to talk to each other at that moment in time, and then other networks talk to each other at the next moment in time, and so on. The functional connectivity has to flow according to the flow of behavior and the flow of the context that you're in and your plans and your goals and everything and how you're, and the updating of that. Now, the idea that you can, that how you change this flow is through gain modulation. So I'm going to talk mainly about gain modulation. So gain modulation, the golden standard is multiplicative or divisive gain. So most neurons, yeah.
So I have a basic sort of architecture question, cortex.
Yeah.
Is it true you could always get there from here? I mean, is it true that any place in cortex there are actually connections that will take you from one region to another, you know, through layer three or diving into the white matter and out? Or is this not that you know, there are regions that get thalamic input and then the projections come out and they're isolated from each other?
I don't know the answer to that precisely. I would say it's most likely true, but I don't know that anybody has. I mean, so you can't make a, you know, no one has ever studied all the connections, right? So no one knows whether it's really true. But the architecture is so diverse, you know, that you could imagine it's true, right? I mean, there's a lot of specificity. But then there are systems that have more global connectivity. So if you really wanted to go someplace, you could go to those systems. You know, like interthalamic nuclei that project over broader regions of cortex or stuff like that. I don't know how much specificity you would get out of that. And that's the question you would then ask next. Well, I could get there, but would I lose information getting there? That kind of thing. I don't know.
So yeah. What do you think is, in your mind, the best example of direct evidence for rerouting of information flow?
The best example is what's called gain fields, I think, in monkeys. This was studied 10 or 20 years ago, where according to where the eye position was, you would get a massive modulation of the excitability of the neuron in visual cortex. And so the idea was that as you move your eyes around, you're moving a gain field around to control the excitability of the neurons to connect visual information to the appropriate motor program. For example, if I'm picking up my laser pointer, I'm looking straight at it, or if I'm looking at my computer, I'm using vision to do that. But you know, while my eyes are moving around, I gotta be able to use that different parts of visual cortex or visual system to guide that motor program. You know, that's gain fields. So then more recently, I have a slide on, maybe we could get to it later. Yuri Butsaki had an experiment. Let me see if I can put some here. Where they had rats run a maze. Yeah. Let's present this. I think this is very interesting. So they had a rat run a maze. Here's the beginning, and he's given a cue, an odor cue, chocolate on the right or cheese on the left, okay? That's always, I think that's kind of cute. But so he sits there and he says, oh, I smell something, so I know that I'm gonna, if I go to the right, I'll get a chocolate reward. So he comes down here and he turns right and he goes down to get the reward. Then another random trial, he might, okay, I have to go left to get the cheese, all right? And then they recorded from hundreds of neurons in the prefrontal cortex with these electrode arrays. And here's the activity of one neuron on different trials where he turned right or turned left, okay? So this particular neuron was very specific for turning right, as you can see in the red, and wasn't very good for turning left. And then what they did was they have all these neurons And they did spike triggered histograms of neuron B versus neuron A for all the different combinations and looked for functional connectivity. Right? So here's one of these shown. And what you see is that when neuron A fires, neuron B has a very likelihood to fire at only a few milliseconds later. So it looks like a monosynaptic connection. But the odd thing is that the connection is only present when he's turning right and only in this part of the maze, you know? So this apparent monosynaptic connectivity or this influence of neuron A and neuron B was very context dependent. When the animal was running and turning right and that part of the maze, there was a very clear connectivity, but otherwise it wasn't very clear. All right.
Yeah. The trivial explanation that it's downstream from another cell. And
yeah, but the idea is that at least for me, maybe both neurons were depolarized at the same point in time, and you could see that connectivity. And other times, one neuron was kind of hyperpolarized, and the other one's kind of depolarized, or vice versa. They weren't synchronized, so you couldn't see the connectivity, right? Yeah. This neuron's firing. Is but it's not being fired. It's the connectivity is not very clear from the other cell. And so they made a map of all the few cells that are recorded here, and the dashed lines are cells that show this type of context dependent expression of their connectivity. Okay. And. All right. So a key question is, how do you change the gain of these input-output curves? Most neurons in the brain have a response function that looks like this. The input might be contrast in the visual system, and the output is firing rate, and it'll have an S-shaped curve. And you can find conditions where this S-shaped curve undergoes multiplicative gain, meaning that each part is multiplied by a factor like 30%, and enhanced or it's divisive decrease. And the idea is that this type of multiplicative gain allows this functional connectivity to occur on the fly, right? So to me, a important question in the cortex is first of all, how do you get these S-shaped curves? I'm not going to address that today. It's not really saturation of firing rate. It's other things like synaptic potentials or synaptic adaptation that gives you this part. This part is pretty well understood. It's an interaction of the noise with spike threshold and inputs. But if you have these S-shaped curves, how do you get a multiplicative gain? And what would that buy you? Okay. So there was a little bit of discussion yesterday about whether neurons are fire or get fired. So neurons in different parts of the brain have very distinct electrophysiological properties. This is an old textbook figure I made some years ago. And some of them are spontaneously active, like Purkinje cells in the cerebellum. And happens to be medial ventricular cell. And we heard about subthalamic nucleus. But cortical neurons, the vast majority of them are not spontaneously active on their own. And they need to get fired, all right? And I'm going to address that now. So cortical neurons, cortical pyramidal cells, and interneurons are all resting far away from firing threshold. They have to be depolarized by about 20 millivolts or so. It varies with cell type and layer and so on. But let's say, on average, it's like 20 millivolts in order to fire an action potential. All right, so they have this giant dead zone. 20 millivolts is really huge. All right, if you want to put it in functional terms, and I'll show you this in a bit. the average firing rate of cortical neurons is thought to be around a hertz or so. There's an argument about that, but it's certainly in that ballpark. Some neurons fire a few hertz spontaneously meaning waking quiescence. Some neurons are firing very, very rarely. But if you look at that basal state, the firing rate of the neuron, cortical neurons, fires on average about 7 hertz per millivolt, right? So if you wanted to double the firing rate of a low firing neuron, 5 hertz to 10 hertz, you wouldn't even have to depolarize at 1 millivolt, right? So 20 millivolts in relation to that is really huge.
But how is this known?
How's what known?
Said 20 millivolts at the blood threshold.
So right here.
Slice.
This is in vivo. And so, and I'll show you a recording like this in a minute. In vivo, in a sleeping animal, that one was from Slice, okay? So this is from a sleeping animal. And what you find in a sleeping animal, in what is the basis of the delta waves you all hear about from, you know, sleep research or in your textbooks, is a slow oscillation. The network turns on and off spontaneously to generate two states. And if you plot the membrane potential of a cell, you'll find these two, this bimodal distribution of the membrane potential. This is minus 70, and that's minus 60, and firing threshold is about minus 53. Okay? So when the network is off, you see the cell's like minus 73, and the firing threshold is minus 53. That's the 20 millivolts. And when
fraction of cells show this?
Hmm?
What fraction of cells show this?
Every cell. Every cell that's recorded shows these up and down states. Now, are they always 20 millivolts? No, some is 5 millivolts and some are 25 millivolts and so on. So this is kind of typical of pyramidal cells.
You have the picture there in waking. Looks like when the animals are awake, that need not be the case, this up and down state.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting now.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
A little data to conclude from that the rest is really 20 millivolt threshold. This could be some slow after hyperpolarization, right? So cells fire after hyperpolarization basically drives the, I mean, has that been ruled out? Because that's a very natural explanation for up and down states.
Yeah. Well, you can spread the up states farther and farther apart so that they can become very rare, like once a minute or something, and the down state just gets longer. It doesn't get deeper or less deep or anything. It just, you just spread them out like this, you know. And that you can do in a slice.
And a slice is worse than, right?
And you can do it in vivo, too. You get high doses of anesthetic, and you just, I'm not saying that the down state is not, has some influence, like you said, like a potassium current. There definitely is, but the majority of it is just the withdrawal of excitation.
David, would you say again which cells have the up and down states?
Pardon?
Which cells have them? You said all of them, but you didn't really mean that.
Yeah, I do.
The spinal cord, the substantia nigra.
Oh, I'm in the cortex. I'm in the cortex, but
the inhibitory neurons have it?
Yes. This is massive and it's huge. And it goes everywhere. The whole brain is blinking. And everywhere that someone has recorded, Charlie did a lot of work in the caudate, in the thalamus. We just did a paper in cerebellum. The cerebellum has its own EEG. It shows the slow oscillations coming from this cortex.
And Purkinje cells show up in down states?
Purkinje cells don't.
So it's not every cell, but there are a lot of cells.
Okay. I would say 80. I'm just guesstimating, but at least 80% of the brain is literally just blinking because it's being driven by the cortex, because this is a huge signal.
So how do you ever get out of the down state?
our ideas, I can't prove them exactly, are that there's a refractory process, all right? It could be a potassium current, like you mentioned, and what happens is that the network is reverberating, and at some low level, it doesn't require a lot of neurons. It requires about 0.1 to 1 hertz firing in the network. And that's kind of reverberating around, but it's building up this refractory process, like a potassium current because of the firing, or maybe synaptic depression. And it gets to a point of criticality where it no longer is able to maintain that reverberation. There are many possible reasons why that would be, but it gets to that point, and then the network fails, and it comes down, and then that refractory process slowly relieves. And then what's happening here is there are spontaneous neurons, and there's also spontaneous transmitter release. Okay? There's lots of spontaneous neurons in other parts of the brain, like thalamus. I mentioned earlier, you know, rhythmically bursting in the thalamus or something. And so as the refractory process recovers, there gets to be a point where the spontaneous activity happens to be able to trigger the transition to the next upstate. The cortex is prepared to generate an upstate, and there's a spontaneous transmitter release or spontaneous firing that is able to trigger that transition to the upstate. So it goes back up, and then it... Now, when exactly an upstate is going to occur is very... It follows a cyclical nature, but predicting it is very difficult because we think that because it's a stochastic kind of process, spontaneous transmitter release or spontaneous action potentials interacting with this cyclical refractory process.
And how synchronous is it over the whole cortex?
Very synchronous, but it propagates quickly.
The campus has the same
No, they don't have up and down states, but they do. They are influenced by up and down states. So, if you look at sharp waves, they're triggered by up and down state transitions.
So actually, we showed that hippocampal CA1 interneurons have up and down states.
Oh, okay.
But hippocampal CA1 pyramidal neurons do not.
Oh, okay.
Like they are not bimodal at all.
Yeah.
The hippocampal CA1 pyramidal neurons get hyperpolarized during the neocortical upstate.
Okay.
So there is a potential possibility that this is disynaptic inhibition,
yeah,
and that it's the hippocampal activity which is projecting to many parts, which could lead to the transition back to the upstate.
Okay. Yeah.
That's one possibility.
Yeah.
Did you say that the whole brain has the same rhythm?
Yeah. Well, it's being it's generating the cortex.
But where? I mean, do you see like spreading from one part to the other?
If you make a slice of the cortex, it propagates laterally across the slice. But if you do it in vivo, it propagates. People have done this in humans during sleep, and they see it mainly in frontal areas, and it propagates posteriorly. It's pretty fast. It's like on the order of 100 millimeters per second, I think.
So it couldn't be exactly synchronous every place.
No. Right. It propagates, but the problem is you have this massively interconnected sheet, and it propagates different every time. I'm sure. You know, it's a little bit different, and so sometimes it's going this way, sometimes on average it's going front to back. But you know, it's highly complicated. So calculating the exact speed of propagation is very difficult. But you could imagine the cortex goes down. And then it has a refractoriness and it's ready to go, but it needs a spark. It needs to for the whole thing to just, you know, go back up.
Does the thalamus have anything to do with this process? Is it involved?
It is strongly influenced by the up and down states. There's an argument about how much it's involved in the triggering of it. You know, whether the spontaneous activity in the thalamus is really triggering the upstates. We know that the upstates trigger activity in the thalamus. There's something called a K complex in sleep, and that's a slow wave followed by a spindle. Spindles are generating the thalamus, so the cortex goes up, hits the thalamus with a strong barrage of activity, and the thalamus rings, and that generates a K complex. But the other way around, I'm sure it happens, but we don't know how prevalent are. Yes,
so
sorry.
If a decorticate animal sleeping and you're corticing the thalamus, what's it doing?
I think it's, I don't know the answer to that, but I would speculate it's mainly during spindle waves. Yeah. Because that's what a phlegmic slice, for example, that is good connectivity, generates just spontaneous spindle waves over and over and over again. All right. Oh. So here's a key point. When the animal wakes up, what you seem to lose is the down states, okay? And why that is, we don't know. We speculate that it's because of the release of acetylcholine or other neuromodulators somehow prevent the cortex from getting to that critical point where it fails and becomes silent for a brief period of time, okay? So the nice thing for us is that because we can generate up and down, we can generate upstates and slices and cultures and anesthetized animals. This is very prevalent type of activity because of the architecture. Because the upstate is kind of like a waking state, we believe that understanding something about this will tell us something about that. All right. Here's an example of the waking activity in this neuron. This is a cat that's not doing anything particular. He's just sitting there in a darkened room. Here's the membrane potential. The membrane potential of the cell isn't flat at all. It varies quite a lot. And this is the distribution of the membrane potential. It has a standard deviation of 2 millivolts. So plus or minus 2 standard deviation would be about 8, 9 millivolts. All right? Which, remember I said 1 millivolt is significant. So this is, during waking, it's not like you're monotonic. The neuron is undergoing quite significant variations, as shown here in the firing rate. So these, we believe these variations here are relevant to waking gain modulation, attention, and so on, gain fields during the waking state. These variations here, if these are significant and important, these are tremendous and huge, probably why during slow wave sleep you're really not very reactive and responsive, and your cognition is very much impaired. All right, because your brain literally is blinking on and off and not able to hold a thought probably for very long. Okay, so the question then becomes, what is the synaptic basis of this ongoing activity during an upstate? And how does it influence neural responsiveness, and what are the functional consequences of that? So this is one upstate recorded in a pyramidal cell. This is multi-unit recording from nearby. This is the field potential recorded nearby. And you'll see from these recordings that the field potential, many people are interested in, is almost a flipped version of the membrane potential of nearby cells in this particular state. All right? So the upstate is made by, strong barrages of synaptic activity, not very strong, but strong enough to depolarize the cell by 24 millivolts in this case. And the synaptic activity has a mean level, but then there's a lot of variance on top of that. Okay? So this is 20 millivolts, so this is several millivolts of ongoing variation. All right? And we believe that these ongoing variations are also very significant in controlling neuronal responsiveness. All right? So if this is like the waking state, it'd be nice to know how this is generated and why these variations are there and what they would do to the neurons. Okay? And what we're hypothesizing is that those variations, this variation is a huge change in gain, and even these variations are ongoing small and rapid changes in gain. Look at the time scale. This is 250 milliseconds, so this one's actually a gamma frequency right here. This will be 40 hertz, and this one's like alpha or beta frequencies here, you know, a few hertz. All right? So the idea is that those ongoing changes reflect the changes in excitability of the neurons, which is context dependent. Here's one, you know, classic example of that type of thing. If you record in prefrontal cortical neurons while monkeys fixates a cue, I mean a fixation point, and then a cue comes on, and then there's a delay where the cue is off, some neurons in prefrontal cortex and other parts of the brain, they'll go from a spontaneous up state, okay, to an even higher rate of firing. And then once the animal moves his eyes to where the point was, the neuron goes back. So we're thinking the neuron's is going around, then okay, it's depolarized even more, and then it comes back. So, right? So the idea is then, if you could look down on the cortex in its flat state, you would see a topography of membrane potential in of all the cells. And this topography would be changing on a moment-to-moment basis as activity flowed in the cortex. And that topography of membrane potential is telling you the excitability map of the cortical neurons, and that's going to strongly influence their functional connectivity.
That was a simulation or data?
Pardon? I don't know what mountain range that was. I just picked it out of Google. Okay, so to give you a feel for this, I'm going to show two movies, I hope they work, of real-time recordings from in vivo an anesthetized animal. This is a pyramidal cell, and this is multi-unit recordings nearby, and this is the field potential. Okay? Let's play that. You're listening to the spikes of that neuron. So although this is a anesthetized animal, what happens during slow-wave sleep is similar, not quite as regular. But you can see all the cells firing, and you can see the field following exactly that, and then the synaptic activity underlying that discharge and generating spikes.
How close is the field potential to the?
It's within about a half millimeter.
And where in the brain exactly are these? Sorry?
We only work in prefrontal cortex or visual cortex, so I'm not sure. I think this is prefrontal cortex.
It says prefrontal.
Oh, okay. Yeah, good.
Now, there are many areas within prefrontal, so do you dorsal, lateral, medial, any of those?
No. Yeah, wouldn't say. Let's listen to the synaptic potentials, okay? Now we've hypolarized the cell, and you're listening to the synaptic activity in this cell. And so now imagine that if you're in the state you are now, hopefully awake, your cortical neurons is suffering this continuously, kind of like that one right there, but keep going, okay? It's just all the time. And I like to show this to people that don't do this kind of recordings, because when you first poke a cell in an animal, you're really kind of shocked about how much synaptic activity is going on all the time. You know, it's like a little storm of activity that's going on all the time, and then there's variations on top of that background. All right. So now I want to address what is the nature of this synaptic activity, and then we'll address what it could actually do to the neurons. So to address the nature of the activity, we first looked at the reversal potential, because that tells you something about the ions that are mediating it. So this is those upstates on single trials at different membrane potentials, and it reverses about minus 30 or minus 40 millivolts. This is in voltage clamp, and this is in current clamp. But even there, okay, I'm not saying it's flat. It's flat on average, but there's a lot of variation around that. So sometimes the reverse potential might be minus 20 or minus 60 or so on. And so, but on average, it's around that. I'm going to show you that right here. So this is average currents of many trials at different membrane potentials. And here's at minus 40 again. And if you plot the reverse potential, the activity starts a little depolarized. We think that's because, you know, long-range connections in the cortex are excitatory. So, and it propagates, as we talked about before. So there's an excitatory wave that comes in. It has a bit of an advantage at the beginning, then inhibition takes over a little bit, and then it kind of flattens out. And this is a very remarkable standard deviation of like 1 millivolt in the reverse potential over a second of activity. Okay? Many, many, many synaptic time constants. So this is the conductance change that we measured in the neuron during this activity. And then if you say, well, this is synaptic activity is mediated by either excitation or inhibition, you can calculate that this should be what the excitation inhibition is doing. The excitation starts a little bit more than inhibition, then the inhibition is a little more than excitation, but then they come just about equal. So that's direct evidence for this long hypothesized balance of excitation inhibition in the cortex. And it's likely just a consequence of the fact that the cortex is made up of massive recurrent excitation, but every recurrent pathway has inhibition as an extra synapse in there to control it. right? So whenever you ramp up excitation, you're going to ramp up inhibition. Yeah.
People talk about variance. There's a bit of confusion, I think, because when Karev and Wolf and Chaim first came out with this idea, they talked about difference between excitation and inhibition. And you, as you see here, and other people talk about ratio.
Balance, we mean proportionality. We mean exactly this, is that as you increase excitation, you increase inhibition, and you get the proportionality.
And Chaim talk about difference.
Well, that's the very nerve conductances.
It's basically the consequence of the balance equation that the weights have to scale all linear before the other. So it's like, I think it's correct that this is a...
David, would you go back 3 slides? I just wanted to ask a quick question.
This one?
That's the one I wanted to see.
Yeah.
So under the voltage clamp,
yeah,
that the current is at around the resting potential is around...
Around the reverse potential, you mean? Here?
No, around the cell's normal resting potential.
Yeah, here? Yeah.
Yeah, it's around a half a nanoamp.
Yeah, 300 picoamps. I mean, 300 picoamps.
So if you took a cell and injected that amount of current, would it fire spikes?
So we've actually done that. I took the slide out, but we did Andrea and I and others, we did an artificial dynamic clamp and we injected back in what we recorded neurons, and the neuron behaves appropriately. Yes, it would.
But if you injected the same current but without the fluctuations,
no, it wouldn't fire spikes.
It would not fire spike.
No, most often no.
So in other words, if you injected that current right there,
yeah,
but filtered it,
yeah. Yeah, that's a point that I'm going to make.
Okay, if you're going to make it later, that's fine.
Well, I took the slide for a time, but what happens? See, here's my so the firing threshold is right about here, and the mean depolarization right here. It gets you close, but not to firing threshold. And what gets you above firing threshold is about a 5 millivolt sharp depolarizing event that crosses firing threshold. And my slide will, one of the summary slides will state this explicitly, but we believe there's two components to firing. One is a kind of a general depolarization, and the other is a rapid depolarization that tells you exactly when to fire.
So what you just said was that there are no contributions to the active currents other than the spikes in that record.
No, yes, I understand. But I think there is some contributions. In particular, in cells that don't get strong synaptic activity, it's been shown that persistent sodium current has a contribution.
Well, no, but every time there's a spike, it turns on after hyperpolarization current,
yeah,
and things like that.
Yeah.
And you're saying that those are so small that you can't see them.
It's generally true. In vivo, you don't see the after hyperpolarization during the synaptic barrages very well.
A lot of noise, so they'd be obscured. So,
well, that's exactly, I was trying to raise that point yesterday with Charlie's talk. The conductance of the neuron is the input resistance of the cells for us is about half of what it would be without any synaptic activity. So that right away cuts down the influence of small currents quite a lot. When you generate a spike with nothing else, there's strong currents during the spike, obviously huge, and then there's a strong current during the first part of the HP, and then you're kind of like just free floating. Small currents can have a huge effect on when the next spike comes. Yeah.
Chuck, if you just give a slow ramp and a slice and you block all synaptic activity, just below threshold you start seeing some oscillations that are about 7 to 10 hertz, which probably are due to interaction with persistent sodium. They go away if you block M current.
I wasn't thinking about persistent sodium.
Well, they're blocked. If you block the M current, for example, KV7s,
yeah,
it's part of that.
What I was thinking
about the conductance slide. The different points on that.
Let's go on. Well, let me try and finish my talk because I only have 15 minutes, and we'll talk about it later. There was just a question about what the different points are. That's the membrane potential at I think a half a millisecond resolution. So this is starting of the upstate, then every at 2,000 hertz or so, this is tracking the membrane potential. The conductance during the build up of the upstate and then coming back down again. Okay?
So you have a 5-fold change in conductance?
Or much more, but.
Why did you just say that it's half?
Hmm?
You just mentioned something about half, the resistance is factor of 1/2.
So this is the change in conductance. I'm sorry. It says conductance, but it's really the change in conductance. From zero would be no change. And so we saw first a 5. So most cortical neurons have a resting conductance of about 10 nanosiemens, okay, 100 megohms or so. 20 nanosiemens would be 50 megohms. So this cell had a change in conductance of an additional 10 nanosiemens, okay?
Is this true, again, not to go too far into that, in different layers? Like in our hands, layer 2 firing rates are like 0.1 hertz, whereas layer 5 is order of magnitude higher.
What cortex is that?
In the parietal cortex and parietal cortex.
Yeah.
We did a little bit of prefrontal too, but systematically layer 2, 3 firing rates in the upstate are close to like 0.1 hertz.
Yeah.
Because layer 5 is like order of magnitude higher. So with your conductance and mean firing rates.
Yes, exactly. It's varied by layer, and this is layer 5.
Okay, yeah, that's right.
Layer 2, 3 is significantly lower firing rate under spontaneous and behaving animals, apparently. There was, I think, a very nice paper recently by Carol Savoda's lab that recorded neurons in a animal that was doing a mouse doing a decision-making task, and they sorted by layer. This had been done many times, but this is the recent incarnation of it. And layer 2, 3 neurons were, many of them were very quiet. Some of them were very active and very selective. It's a scary finding in a way, because what it means is that all these studies which are concentrating on superficial layers because they're using imaging are probably recording from irrelevant cells, if you consider the cells that don't fire as irrelevant, right? And what they found was a small fraction, like 5% of the neurons, fired very intensely, meaning 50 hertz or so, pyramidal cells, and very selectively. They you could use that information to say exactly where the manipulandum was, but only 5% of the layer 2, 3 cells. But if you go to layer 5, it's much denser code. Many cells fired, layer 4 and layer 5.
David, is that true of all areas of the cortex, or because this was, you said
I'm
was
not
in
sure
the parietal cortex, which has a very low fire.
We haven't.
What about visual cortex?
We've this type of activity shows laminar specificity in V1, in prefrontal, in somatosensory. So that's the parts we've recorded. Yeah.
Even in layer 5, there's 5A versus 5B, there's a huge difference in firing rate.
Yes.
There's a DeCock and Sackman paper showing that.
Yep. Yeah, and fast spiking neurons show a high firing rate, and others neurons don't. And then here's one fortuitous recording that we got during a visual stimulus paradigm, and I just wanted to point it out. Now, this is completely, you know, raw kind of speculative data, but it makes sense. This is the firing rate of the neuron, and then we put QX314 in an electrode to block sodium currents and cesium, and then we looked at the EPSPs and the IPSPs in the neuron in response to a visual stimulus. It was a natural movie, and we compared the firing of the neuron to the EPSPs and the IPSPs. These are on different trials, but the same movie. It's an unparalyzed anesthetized cat. And you see that the firing of the neuron, which it occurs at very particular times, lines up with an abundance of EPSPs and a withdrawal of IPSPs. Right? So there was a barrage of E's and a withdrawal of I's, and that the neuron discharged. And here the cell discharges large E's and not much I's, and then the I's turn on. So there seems to be this kind of push-pull between E's and I's.
Which is not quite the same as balance.
No, it's not. That's why I brought this up, because what I'm trying to, that's why I said right here, is there's a general balance, but then you have this variation on top of it, which, you, so the general balance gets you closer to firing threshold, and the variance says when you should spike exactly. And that variance is a fight between E's and I's. Sometimes E's are more abundant, and I's are less abundant, and vice versa. And so you would go, this is in current climb, so you'd be high polarized, depolarized, like that. Yeah.
Did you do a spike triggered average of the
No.
Pseudo spike triggered of the specs are not at the same time.
Right. No, we don't have that precision. And we didn't do that.
But
you could do that by.
You have that. So I mean, that picture was.
Yeah, that's what that is, but it's not a single spike triggered, it's a histogram triggered.
Can you show the picture again?
Yeah, I can show it again.
Yeah. I just showed this because I wanted to state this again. This is the general balance of E's and I's, and then you have these rapid variations on top of that, which, you know, unless you're talking about intrinsic conductances, if it's synaptically mediated, it must be. No, it doesn't. I'm sorry, I take that back. It could be E's and I's are going up exactly, because the reverse potential is minus 40. So if you increase E's and I's exactly the same amount, you would depolarize the cell because you're trying to bring it to minus 40. But what seems to be the case, rather, is if this preliminary data is correct, is that this is probably an excess of E's and a withdrawal of I's, and then that's a withdrawal of E's and a more I's right there.
In that picture, how much variance is there in the threshold, spike threshold?
I haven't measured that.
Where is the
spike
triggered average?
No, these are spikes. So this is, so we didn't do a spike triggered average. This is a histogram triggered average. You could say that you could relate this to that. If I lined all these peaks up or the spikes, you would have that, but.
Well, that's the PSTH. That's
yeah, those are spikes.
No, I meant, you know.
I don't have a spike trigger average. This is the relationship of E's and I's to spiking.
The single trace was to the average over many.
Many, average of many,
so
many.
So the mutual PSTs would be variations around.
Yes.
Curves, right?
Yes.
So there's additional.
Yes, but remember, as I said, this is on completely different trials than that one and that one. So that that fine timing is lost. Okay, we don't have it. You can't record E's and I's and spikes at the same time. It's not,
but you could,
not possible.
You could still look at the average current at the time where there should be a spike.
Yeah, but that's what you show, right? These are average currents at the particular point in the movie.
I am comfortable doing this. Yeah, you could do that.
Cross-correlation of the PCH.
You could do that. I mean, you could. And you would have a very strong caveat that, you know, the fine timing is gone, and don't read too much into that.
Frenek did that in ED1. And it's on this pipe, basically. So the basically rate of excitation followed by longer inhibition.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm going to skip ahead.
I'm going to see that slide.
the one you just took away.
I'm going back, so you will see that one in a minute.
Oh, okay, fine.
I decided I won't skip ahead too fast, because really this is the key point I wanted to get to, so I'm going to take the time to go over it. So so there are many, many different ways to modulate gain or responsiveness. You could shift everything up. You could shift everything to the left. You could have a multiplicative gain. This would be, if you compare contrast versus response, this might be called contrast gain. You're just shifting the input-output curve along the contrast curve. This is, contrast is what you typically manipulate in vision. This would be a multiplicative gain. This might be an offset with a multiplicative gain. At least the theoreticians are very excited about this, and because you don't have a big change, and if you want to consider this noise in this signal, you know, where there's no contrast, what the spontaneous firing rate is, you get a nice signal, the noise enhancement. But, you know, It's dangerous to call spontaneous activity noise. That's the whole point. So what do you see in an actual animal? And this, again, like most things in neurobiology, is controversial. But you have a monkey's fixate on a target, and he has to keep his eye there. And then he's cued either a 10 to the left or a 10 to the right. And this would be the receptive field of the neuron, for example. So he's either attending to the receptive field, or he's attending away from the receptive field of the neuron that they're recording, usually in V4, but other visual areas too. And this is an example of what you would see. I picked this one on purpose because it gave the best multiplicative like gain change. This was from John Maunsel's lab.
And the axis is contrast?
Yeah, so this is contrast. So 0 is a gray screen, 3%, 6%, up to 100% contrast is a period of black and white bars. And this is firing rate. And this is when the monkey's attending away from the receptive field. And this is when the monkey's attending to the receptive field. In this particular case, look, there is a bit of an offset. There's a little change in spontaneous firing rate of the neuron. But there also is kind of something you could fit well with the near multiplicative gain change. All right? So how would you get that? The question is, if you're imagining the neuron that has this response, and is what's happening in that cell to increase its activity in that way? So that becomes the key question. So what could you do to this neuron to increase its gain in a multiplicative way? And we're hypothesizing that, you know, changes the functional connectivity of the cortex. So you could bombard that neuron with synaptic activity. And if you bombard that neuron with synaptic activity, you would necessarily change probably the membrane potential, the conductance, the variance we call noise, but it's really just membrane potential variance on the cell. So then the question becomes, and this is just a graphical representation of that. You change the membrane potential, you change the input conductance, and you change the amount of variance of the membrane potential. So the question then becomes, what are these three things do to the responsiveness of the cortical neuron? All right? So what Andrea and I did with Yuxiang Xu was we recorded from pyramidal cells, and we independently varied those three things, the variance, the membrane potential, the conductance, at this point clamp, while we injected at the same point inputs of different types to see what they would each do, all right? So we're going to change the membrane potential, the conductance, and the variance to look at how that affects spiking in the neuron.
What does it mean by changing noise means changing potential or just adding current?
Just changing the variability with a white noise input of the membrane.
Current?
You were injecting a model conductance.
And changing membrane potential also means injecting current?
Yes. A conduct, yeah. Right. 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 I'm sorry. We have a dynamic clamp, and if we want to just make variance, we inject a current, but not a conductance. If we want to change conductance, we inject a conductance with the dynamic clamp. If we want to change membrane potential, we just inject current. So we're keeping those three things separate. And then we mix them together to see how they interact. Okay?
But you could change noise by fluctuating the conductance, the principle.
Yes. Yeah, but then you're fluctuating conductance and membrane potential. All right, so then on top of that, let me back up. So first thing we did was we asked what the natural up state does to responsiveness of the neuron. So this is a slice that we have that generates up and down states, okay? And we injected into that EPSP-like conductances that were of various random amplitudes. And then the slice generated an up state, and then it was kind of quiescent, and it generated an up state. And we had these random EPSP-like events going on during this, and then we sorted it out afterwards according to the size and if it occurred during an upstate or a downstate. All right? And this is what you get. This is several cells. And it's normalized so that the synaptic conductance that we injected that caused the cell to fire about half the time was 1. All right? So during the down state, the neuron acts as a threshold detector. If there was no noise at all, this should be a straight line. Right? There'd be a threshold, and if you cross that, this cell would spike. And
so David, when you injected your synaptic conductance,
yeah,
did you assume that the conductance was all on the soma?
Yeah, that's all at the point of the electrode.
Sort of, in many cases, it's more realistic to inject synaptic current rather than to inject conductance because most excitatory synapses are decoupled.
Yeah. So for the purpose of this particular one, it didn't matter whether it was really a conductance or a current. We got the same result. And you'll see why in a second. So you probably already know why, but the upstate with the synaptic barrages, the input-output of the neuron looked like this now. It's not so much a threshold detector, but more of an S-shaped probabilistic response, because that input is arriving in the presence of noise, variance, right? And so now the neuron, because of that variance, brings the cell close to firing threshold and is depolarized. Okay, the upstate depolarizes the cell close to firing threshold and there's variance on top of that. The neuron can respond to very small inputs, whereas before it never responded. So now it can respond, but it responds in a probabilistic way. It only responds on 1/10 of the trials, right? So you get some throughput, but it's noisy.
I'm not understanding. Where does time come into this? What does normalized synaptic conductance means? An instantaneous conductance?
It could be,
or a mean conductance?
You know, a few a nanosiemen or something of conductance.
But I mean, how long was it staying there?
No, it was just a synaptic event. It was like a 20 millisecond event.
It was 10 milliseconds or 5 milliseconds.
Yeah, a few milliseconds event.
And then when you look at the probability, you ask what the probability of seeing within a certain length of time after that event, a spike was.
Yeah, so let's pick one out that, this is going to be a little bit of a visual search, but so this one here, you see, when in upstate, it made the cell fire, whereas one that was similar in amplitude during the downstate didn't make it fire.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so we counted the number of times we injected that particular size and the number of spikes that we got in those two states and plotted it. And that's what you're looking at here. Okay? So now, in the presence of this upstate, the neuron is quite responsive, but in a probabilistic way, you know. Now, so the two things you see happens is that this shifts to the left and the slope changes. Okay? So it shifts to the left, it's much more responsive, and the slope changes. You might call this a gain decrease, although the cell's much more responsive.
And you hadn't blocked synaptic conductances in this slice.
No, this is naturally occurring up and down states.
So, these are naturally occurring.
Yeah. Yeah, this is all spontaneous.
So the reason it was probabilistic, the noise that was caught, probabilistic was the synaptic noise.
Yes.
Okay.
And that's what we're going to test now. We're going to figure out why these, what are these, why did you get this effect? Okay? So we independently varied three things: membrane potential, conductance, and noise. There's no synaptic activity now. We block synaptic activity. Okay? And so we inject into the neuron these random EPSP-like events, and then we just change membrane potential, minus 61, minus 68, minus 72. And this is the input-output curve. It stays a threshold function, and it just shifts laterally because you're getting the cell closer and closer to firing threshold as you depolarize, right? Now, I want you to notice, there's one really important thing to notice, is that this is a 2 millivolt change. You have a pretty significant effect on the shift, on the output. You have a big effect. By 2 millivolts, you have this big effect, all right? Here, this is 11 millivolts. Remember, upstates are 20 millivolts, all right? You have this tremendous effect on input-output of the neuron just by shifting a few millivolts. So voltage changes are really powerful in changing excitability, all right? Here's the conductance change. This is the pretty much the average strong, this is a pretty strong conductance change, right? Often we saw them at only 10. We saw, we were talking about that earlier slide. It was, it peaked at about 10 nanosiemens. Here's one that's 20 nanosiemens, all right? And you saw that, you saw a shift to the right. The neuron's less excitable. It's still a threshold function that shifts to the right, okay? 20 nanosiemens in most cortical pyramidal cells would give you a 15 or 20 millivolt depolarization. Here's 11 millivolts. So you saw this big of a shift with 11 millivolts. With conductance change, you saw that big a shift to the other way, all right? So for as in the operating regime that this synaptic barrage is working, voltage has a much bigger effect than the conductance change. Okay? So the conductance change of 10 millivolts will be like that, but the shift to the left would be like this. Okay? So it's about maybe 10 times more effective.
You can't have a voltage change without conductance changes, right? And so what you're saying is that the conductances you're looking at are decoupled from the cell by a series of resistance.
Now what I'm saying is that the conductance changes that are naturally occurring during upstates are small in their effect in comparison to the effect that the voltage change has. You could do it another way. You could have a massive inhibition,
but how do you change the voltage of a cell without changing conductances?
We just inject current.
No, I mean in real life.
In real life. Yeah, we're doing it independently right now just to separate the three.
Like the point you made, the conductance is remote from the soma.
Yeah.
So the current's flowing to the soma. The soma's, the conductance of the soma may not be changing, but the current.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We can also just change the reversal potential. Yeah. So what he's doing here is you got two reversal potentials, and you get some kind of ratio that gives you the same conductance but a different reversal potential. So if excitation went up and inhibition went down, the net conductance would be the same. The reversal potential would have shifted.
That's not exactly what we did, but you could do that, yeah.
So it seems you had the change in slope as well.
That's this. Okay. So now all we do is we inject these synaptic-like currents, conductances, and then we have either zero noise, one times noise, or two times noise, mean variance, okay, and white noise injected into the cell, all right? And then we ask what happens to the input-output curve. When there's no voice variance, it acts like a threshold detector. And when you increase variance, it changes the slope around the 50% point. 0%, 50%. It's right around that. It just drifts, right? So you change slope by variance. You change position by voltage or conductance. All right? Why is that? Okay? If you turn the lights on here. So imagine three size EPSPs and no variance. So here's threshold. And this one is able to make the cell spike. So it's a threshold detector. And so you go along and zero, zero, and then one. It makes the cell spike, okay, like that. Now, if you add on top of that noise, right, if you add on top of that variance, and the variance is random, so it's different from trial to trial. So that small event that never made the cell fire, sometimes it could occur on top of this one and reach firing threshold. And other times it'll occur in the trough and it won't. And so it has an ability to make the cell fire, right? So that small, there will be very small events that will never make the cell fire. So that those small events now will make the cell fire sometimes, but on a probabilistic way because it depends on where it lands on top of the noise, right? Now imagine that you had a medium one, this large one that could make the cell fire. But this large one, since the variance is both positive and negative, around zero, it might occur during a trough, And although it used to make the cell fire, it doesn't make the cell fire as often now. So this point goes here, and it goes like that. All right? So now you get an S-shaped function, whereas before you had a step function. And it swivels around 50%. And the amount that swivels depends on the amount of variance you inject. Right? This is, I believe, stochastic resonance, or related to that.
How big is the variance of the current during natural inputs?
Yeah, that's a very good point, because when people were doing this, modelers were doing this, Larry Abbott and Landis Dex, they were injecting huge variances.
How big is the actual variance?
So remember I said in the waking animal, the membrane tensile variance was 2 millivolts, standard deviation was 2 millivolts. So that would be similar to this right here, this noise one. And so that would be similar to this one right here. This,
yeah, what's the variance of the current, the underlying current?
I don't know exactly, but 50, if you
picoamps,
I don't know.
So, anyway, the stuff I started with, I knew you were going to do this, so I put that in because it's exactly the opposite result, where the variance of the current actually increased the slope. And that's if you, in layer 2-3 cells, or actually in some layer 5 cells, if you let them go along for a while and you build up an AHP and get some sodium inactivation, then they basically want bigger DVDTs, and then the variance actually increases the gain. I think most layer 2-3 cells, at least after a second of firing, will behave that way, which is opposite to this.
Well,
that will be a little controversial.
Well, I think, you know, you're right in that the result you get depends on, see what I just plotted over here was, it depended on the ability of those synaptic-like events to fit inside the troughs, so that they could be reduced. But if you're putting in like current pulses like you were doing, those are much slower.
There was noise.
You're injecting noise on top of noise?
We were injecting noise with the DC off.
Yeah, that's the DC. You were modulating the DC and the noise, yeah. And you're looking at the one, the X was, I think, the mean.
The X axis was just mean, so
right.
There's only one variable going along the X axis.
Yeah, but that's, yeah. What I'm saying is that you have this big, very slow component, that the interactions you get are different, and that's where, actually my next slide.
Okay.
But here, I just wanted to summarize what we found was that the during an upstate, the change in membrane tension has a huge effect on excitability. The change in conductance has a significant but small effect, opposite, and a change in variance has a big effect on the slope. If you're looking at sharp short events that can fit inside these variabilities.
So you say change membrane potential, you mean change injected current?
No, now I'm talking just spontaneous. Just we actually did this. We measured these in a real up and down states, then we injected fake ones, and we got exactly the same result, it turns out. That's the summary figure of the paper, that we could explain the change in firing probability of the cell just by these three things. I don't know if that answers your question, but it turns out that yeah, you could worry about all the locations of the conductance on the dendrites and stuff, but it turned out pretty good that we could just inject in the soma the average change in membrane potential, the average change in conductance, and the average change in variance, and we got the same effect as what on average occurred during a natural upstate. Yeah?
So it seems like the way you explained it, the probability of firing should be related to the cumulative density function of the distribution of membrane voltage. So if you just plot the cumulative density function of the distribution of membrane voltage, can you make a quantitative fit to the probability of firing as a function of synaptic conductance?
We haven't done that, but I'm going to show you something kind of related to that, I think, in a second. So if I don't, then you can come back to that. So Chance and Abbott published a paper, a theoretical paper, which they did in single neurons and slices, saying that, okay, if you wanted to get a gain change in the cortex with the tension, the way you should do it is by silencing synaptic activity. And that if you did it just right, so that there's no change in membrane potential, you could get this slope change like this. So here's with lots of variance. And then we reduce the variance, okay, which is going to increase the slope. And then we reduce the conductance, which is going to shift this to the left to keep the origin the same. So they said we could get gain changes. So they were imagining that when a monkey pays attention, what happens is that actually all this synaptic bombardment becomes quiet and without changing memory potential somehow, so that you could have this multiplicative gain change like this. All right? Now, here's the problem. This doesn't really work in vivo, you know? And I'm going to show you data that suggests it doesn't work like that in vivo. All right? And then I can stop there because I'm already running over. So, and I think this is related to a bit to the question that was just asked. So in a normal animal, there's always synaptic noise going on. And because of that synaptic noise, the neurons don't act as a threshold detector. They act with this slope at the foot of their input-output curve. And also neurons, their firing rate almost never saturates. Pyramidal neuron can fire a couple hundred hertz. And you know, most firing rate of neurons in the cortex, the relevant firing rate is somewhere between zero and a few hertz, or maybe 50 hertz. All right. So you're at this kind of base part of the input, of the firing rate curve for the neuron. And because of the synaptic variance that's going on, the input. This is a real neuron during real responses. This is membrane potential versus spike firing rate, and it looks like this. It has this what can be fit by a power law function. All right, the line is actually power law, and the dots are real data.
Right? So, David, I don't understand how you got the abscissa.
Yeah.
Because the membrane potential is fluctuating, and so you must have averaged it somehow.
So this is the membrane potential, like for 50 milliseconds before the cell.
So you'd average 50 milliseconds before the cell fired a spike.
Yeah.
And that's what you plotted down there.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah, and. So if it was minus 75, it was very unlikely the cell was going to fire within 50 milliseconds or so.
So what was the autocorrelation time of the membrane pulse? Is it right to average over 50 milliseconds?
Yeah, you're missing the gamma frequency oscillations and so on. So that should be taken into account. I'm fuzzy on whether it's exactly 50 milliseconds or what the time base was.
What's the power of the power law?
It varies between cell types a lot. And I seem to remember, so for pyramidal cells, it's around 1.8 or so. And for interneurons, it's like 4. There's a huge difference.
Also, do you know at this point if it's a power law or an exponential? Why power law? Mm-hmm.
The data is fit very well with a power law, and I assume, I don't know if it's more poorly fit by exponential.
I'm just curious if they're distinguishable at this point.
I don't know. I believe they are, but we haven't done that. Yeah. This doesn't look exponential to me, but it's too, you know. All right, what would that buy you, okay? And this is by Ken Miller. He has a very nice paper on this. He took our data I'm going to present next and then explained it with this observation. The key observation is this power law relationship in the presence of noise. So if you had a variance of some parameter like contrast, and this is the variance of the firing rate, and this is normalized. It's not really meant to be 1 hertz. It's normalized. They normalized to this peak of 1 hertz. And so this could be contrast, and this could be firing rate. And then you just change membrane potential of the cell, all right? In a parallel situation, what's that going to do? If you change the membrane potential by 5 millivolts, okay? So if you went 5 millivolts here, you would have a small increase in responsiveness, or 3 millivolts. You'd have a very small increase in responsiveness. But over here, 3 millivolts would have a significant increase in firing rate, okay? And so if you multiply change in membrane potential by the power law function, what you get is this. It's not exactly multiplicative gain, but it's close. It's close enough that experimentalists could never tell the difference. It's not multiplicative gain, but it's close. So when you have a very small, you get a small enhancement, right? When you have a large input, you get a large enhancement. Absolute-wise, percentage-wise, it turned out to be pretty similar. Not exactly, but it's close enough that experimentalists would not be able to tell. I'll present the last couple of slides and what we found, then we'll stop. So we went to the animal and asked what actually happens under more naturalistic conditions, so to speak, with real stimuli instead of these artificial conductances and so on. So we took a cat who's looking at a computer screen, who's anesthetized, and we presented stimuli to the computer screen while the cortex spontaneously behaved. Now, this was the effect in the monkey that was attending to a particular place or not. This is the effect in the cat who's anesthetized, and all we do is change the membrane potential of the cell. All right? We inject current, not conductance, we just inject some current so that the cell is either 8 millivolts below where it normally rests on average. All right? And what we found was a kind of multiplicative-like change in the responsiveness of the neuron. This is contrast, and this is firing rate. Right? This is average data over many cells. Right. So just changing membrane potential had this effect. And that's exactly what Miller's study predicted. In fact, their study was after ours, so they used our data to say that this is the kind of effect you would get because of this power law relationship.
So you could get that by increasing inhibition.
Well, you need to depolarize, so you would decrease inhibition.
Or decrease inhibition, right.
Yeah.
Depending which way you want to go.
You could decrease anything that would depolarize the cell, and they model it in different ways. They threw on EPSPs, or they threw on, I don't know if they withdrew inhibition, but they probably did.
I mean, to mimic your experiment, they have to use IPSPs, right? Because you decrease the membrane potential. And so if they were far away, then they'd be decoupling, injecting an average current. So that would do it.
So this is another experiment, a little more natural. So we said, well, if membrane potential will have this effect, maybe spontaneous changes in membrane potential will have the effect. Okay? So during an up state, the membrane potential is spontaneously fluctuating. Remember I said during waking, standing deviation is about 2 millivolts, so your spread is about 10 millivolts. Here's a spread of about 5 millivolts, okay? So this is well within the range of what would be occurring in an animal's neuron during waking behavior. So then what we did was we present visual stimuli very briefly, 50 milliseconds, at different, just randomly, and they were random contrasts, all right? So then we plot an input-output curve for the neuron, contrast versus firing rate, and then we sorted the data whether the cell was hyperpolarized or depolarized spontaneously on its own because of network activity. And this is the input-output curve when the cell is at minus 72, for example, and this is the input-output curve when the cell is at minus 62. So there was this kind of multiplicative gain change.
And how much time did you average over to get the voltages?
Again, I think it was, you know, around 50 milliseconds or so. So if we flashed here, it would be just before the flash, what was the membrane potential.
Can I ask a naive question?
Yeah.
Can you just go into some cell in the monkey or the cat while they actually are attending and see if you get this change in membrane potential?
Yeah, that would be great. The problem is...
That's my 7-to-19 question.
No. It's a really good question. It's a really good question, and we really would like to do that. The whole problem is stability, yeah? The brain moves, especially if the cranium is opened. And so people are trying to do that kind of thing, but it's extraordinarily technically challenging because the size of the movement is much bigger than the size of the cell, you know, often. And so if you're electrode static, the cell can just pop on and off, it'll just kill it. So some people, there's tricks. One is to move the electrode with the brain movement, you know, and the other is to seal the skull as much as possible and to keep everything, once the pressure has returned to normal, then it doesn't move as much. The main movements are not just movements of the animal, but cardiac rhythm, your brain.
So barring that, which is obviously the thing you'd like to do best,
yeah.
Can you mimic attention by changing neuromodulators in an anesthetized animal that then can show that actually changes the voltage?
So here's the point, and that's why I can just make it right here and we can stop. But the point is that attention occurs on a rapid time scale. You know, gain fields are occurring very rapidly. As you move your eyes around, the neurons that are connecting the visual flow to the motor program, you need to, it's almost instantaneous. You'd never be able to hit a baseball or a tennis ball. You know what I mean? So this has to be a very rapid response. It can't be done like by neuromodulators because their responses go through G proteins. They're naturally slower. All right. So whatever the process is, it increases the response of the neuron. It has to be within 10 to 100 milliseconds or so.
Or not a slower attention.
There are slower attentional mechanisms, but I'm more interested in the rapid changes that allow real time behavior to occur. And so we think that these type of fluctuations in membrane potential that can occur very rapidly, this is a 10 millivolt change in 20 or 50 milliseconds, and then on top of that, you have these, are much more likely to play that role. So you would like to know in the animal, when he shifts his attention without moving his eyes, or when he moves his eyes from one place to another, does the membrane potential rapidly change? In that we can only get that kind of information from an electrode, maybe from some imaging.
So it's in barrel cortex, we find slightly different result.
Yeah.
That in the similar anesthetized animals, anesthetized animals.
Yeah.
During the up state, if you deflect a whisker by 0.3 degrees,
yeah.
You get lesser number of action potential than in the down state.
Yeah, we have the same result, and I think that's a curiosity of the barrel cortex. And Andrew did a study on that, and to make a long story short, what we found was that during the down state, a whisker deflection can make a very synchronous, strong input that actually triggers an up-like state. And then what she did was, which I thought was really smart, was she tweaked the whisker and then looked at the ability of the cortical neuron to encode the velocity of the whisker. And during the down state, it encoded it much more poorly than during the up state. So the up state, the down state in that particular case is explosively responsive to a whisker twitch, but encodes information very badly. And then the up state, it doesn't have that explosive responsiveness, but it does have the better encoding. Yes.
So your membrane potential centric view, I just want to raise a question about that. So when you hyperpolarize, do you know if there's a conductance decrease? The reason I'm asking is, like John White, for example, has some data that I saw somewhere that, you know, if you just raise the conductance without changing membrane potential, then the cell the gain actually increases to fluctuating current again through, because it becomes more of a differentiator. And so, you know, when you're hyperpolarizing there, you're probably also changing the conductance due to the intrinsic stuff that you're turning on and off. I don't know if you've actually measured what that is in this case, but. So yeah, for example, in that case, you could get the same kind of effect without any change in membrane potential just by changing, for example, the amount of inhibition and excitation in balance or some intrinsic conductances, you know, from some modulator, right?
Okay, so if we go back to our slice work on the responsiveness of the neuron, and we go to the measurements of the fluctuations of synaptic potentials that generate these changes in membrane potential, the conductance changes that's doing this are relatively small, especially in their effectiveness on excitability in comparison to the changes in membrane potential. If these were huge changes in conductances that were changing this, which you could do by, you know, depending on the reverse potential, whatever's happening, then I would say that conductance changes might have a very significant effect.
Well, I'm just talking about the DC conductance when you're hyperpolarized, because maybe you shut off.
It doesn't change enough to have a big effect. The change in membrane potential has a tenfold effect over conductance changes. So, you know, you really have to keep that in mind. It's 10 times stronger in the conductance ranges we're talking about.
Yeah, so is there much evidence for a lot of sub-threshold active currents that would be turned on and off in these cells?
Mike talked about persistent sodium current the other day, which could give you a 30% boost or something in apparent input resistance. But that's under ideal conditions. So I think those are modulating influences, but they're not the main story. I really strongly believe that the membrane potential changes are the main story. And with that, I'm gonna stop.
Any other last question?
Yeah. So there was a modeling study explaining up and down by
was particularly relevant for superficial cortical neurons that give very mild synaptic inputs. And I think that I'm not disagreeing with that study. I'm saying it's then in those cases, we didn't need it. Because the synaptic conductances we measured were several times more, even though they're not that big, several times more than the very mild synaptic conductances they used in that study. It was a layer two. They're talking about a study in layer 2-3 pyramidal cells in which they found that the intrinsic sodium current, persistent sodium current contributed in their model of it significantly to the generation of upstates. And I'm saying that in our cells, which are layer 5, the density of synaptic current is much greater, and we didn't need to add that sodium current to get the depolarizations we saw.
Now, I also think that the synaptic conductances are so great that the intrinsic conductance it's almost nothing compared to the effects of the synapse.
Synaptic conductances on the soma.
No, but even, okay, that's true. That's the all the synaptic conductances out in the thing, but the load, the resistive load that it's creating out in the basal dendrites is pretty heavy, and most of the inputs here are in the basal dendrites. We heard in Jackie's talk that they're not that far away.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Most people think of the apical dendrite for some reason. The apical dendrite is only a few percent of the synapses. Most of the synapses is coming in a 300 micron radius around the soma.
And most of them are decoupled by spines.
Yeah, that's
big,
true.
High spine. So it's not clear that the conductance that you measure in the soma reflects those conductances changes.
No, it doesn't. There's very local high conductance changes and so on. But so when I measured 20 nanosievens conductance change, that was at the soma. That's the cumulative effect at the soma. And lucky for us, the spike initiation zone's not too far away from the soma. So I think it's relevant because of that, just because of that.
Coming back to this question of the balance state, the qualitative prediction of that theory is that if you were able to switch off inhibition or inhibitory input to this node, it would be far super threshold. So, and that's what I understood was Chuck's question. So if you are really capable of isolating the excitatory drive, is it so strong that the neuron would find like right crazy if...
Well, you get seizures,
yeah.
Right?
Sure. So,
and so that's inhibitory in the network. I mean,
yeah, sure.
If you could do it in a single neuron, yeah, it should, but there aren't any very good ways to block inhibition in a single neuron. And that would be a good question if we could do that. We can't easily block it on a... Some people have applied GABA-A blockers inside a cell and claim that blocks inhibition on that cell. I'm not sure that's... Since it's only been published once or twice, I don't think it really works.